On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Imagine you're the reporter in a dusty field near the Baghdad airport yesterday, surrounded by hundreds of components for making deadly roadside bombs. The U.S. military has laid them out for your inspection, and the whole exercise is pointing the finger of blame at Iran. It's the third time in 2 weeks. You know that war drums are beating in Washington. You know the U.S. and Iran could go to war, and this could be cited as the reason. But you and the world also remember Colin Powell's briefing on alleged Iraqi WMD that proved to be smoke. Not an easy situation. Last time the U.S. press muffed it, got spun. What about now? Up next on Point, war drums, Iran, and whether the U.S. media is getting it right this time. We will hear in this hour from a top reporter and the public editor of the New York Times. But first, joining me from Newark, New Jersey, is Christina Borgeson, an Emmy and Murrow Award-winning investigative journalist who's worked for CBS and CNN. She's editor of the book Feet to the Fire, The Media After 9/11, which examined the press and the road to war in Iraq. Christina Borgeson, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And with us from New York is John Rick MacArthur, president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. He's author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War. Rick MacArthur, thanks for being here.
I'm delighted to be here, although a little bit saddened also.
Let's go straight to that. Just yesterday, again, near the Baghdad airport, the U.S. military laid out a field full of bomb components, the finger pointed again at Iran. American reporters reporting this, and also every time now, pointing out their skepticism about this or that angle or what they don't know. On balance, do you think the press is doing a better job this time than before the Iraq war?
Well, they couldn't do a worse job than they did before the invasion of Iraq. I mean, that was extraordinary. With all the so-called skepticism, you have to read these stories very carefully. What we're really talking about here is the New York Times leading the pack again on disinformation, or at least on what I think is probably disinformation coming from the Bush administration, designed not only to build a case for bombing Iran, but also to distract attention from the disaster in Iraq and from the fact that most of the American soldiers being killed are being killed by the Sunni insurgents. But if you look at the specific stories that they've been running, the skepticism, yes, there is more skepticism, official skepticism, than there was before the invasion of Iraq. But it's qualified skepticism. If you look, for example, at the story they ran yesterday in the Times, they talk, yep. They go and quote the skeptics that they quote are the liberals, quote unquote, at the National Security at the Center.
Joseph Cerencioni, Center for American Progress.
Yeah, right. Joseph Cerencioni at the Center for American Progress, quote, a liberal research and advocacy organization. You never hear anybody quoting a high administration source in the New York Times being referred to as a self-interested or a reactionary or a conservative or a neoconservative source. So you got to be very careful about giving the New York Times too much credit for its own official skepticism. And well, I think we'll get to that with the public editor a little bit later.
Yes, we will. We'll hear from New York Times reporter Michael Gordon as well. Christina Borgeson, tough charge there from Rick MacArthur saying the New York Times is involved in disinformation again. What do you see happening this time compared to before the Iraq war? Has the U.S. press learned? Are we getting the straighter story? Is the press capable of getting behind this kind of flurry of allegations, of charges coming from the government?
Look, there's no doubt that the press is absolutely capable of doing it. I mean, the New York Times, unfortunately, is always, to a lesser and greater extent, depending on the issue, a victim of what I call official source reporting. And is it disinformation? Well, you know, the journalistic response is always, well, this is what our leader said, and we have to report what our leader says. So, unfortunately, our leaders are not being terribly honest these days. My big concern beyond that is the fact that, I mean, context is absolutely absent. It's fascinating to me that they're presenting all these weapons that the Iranians ostensibly helped and may very well have, you know, helped put together or contributed. But by the same token, ever since the Iraq Study Group came out and said, literally, the Iraq Study Group came out and said, well, you know, the Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are supporting the Sunnis in the insurgency. And, of course, there are never any presentations of what of any materiel or money or evidence of this side of the thing. You know, it's already, again, when the press was discussing whether or not it was a, you know, a civil war in Iraq, the Iraq Study Group comes out and says, listen, it's a regional conflict that, you know, given the information they provide, it's a regional. So the press is always, first of all, the context is always lacking, and the press is always, it's always behind. You know, it's just, it's, if you know, this time there are more, obviously there are other journalists in the mainstream who are trying harder and are more skeptical, and there is more skepticism, and my God, why shouldn't there be? But, you know, the problem is that it's not enough, particularly when you're looking at something as grave as, you know, a war in Iran.
So you say always behind, Christina, but you say it doesn't have to be. What's a reporter supposed to do? I mean, we've got the story today. Here, the military has U.S. reporters out in a field near the airport. Here's a whole field full of bomb components. They're pointing to, you know, to plastic bags saying this has got plastics explosives and this has serial numbers from Iran and this, you know, and so on and so on. There it is. U.S. soldiers are dying from these things. Americans care about that. What's that reporter supposed to do?
Well, that reporter is supposed to put it in context, you know. That reporter, yes, American soldiers are dying. What is the context in which the American soldiers are dying? They're dying as a result of a war that was sold on false pretenses. The press, I mean, I did that entire book, Feet to the Fire. Mm-hmm. I interviewed 21 of this nation's top reporters.
Did you hear remorse?
They still don't know. They still do. No, that's not my point, mm-hmm. because we're supposed to report information. They still don't know why we went to Iraq. And now we're on our way to Iran, and they're using the same, you know, the same, they're using the exact same tactics. They're using the exact same language. And, you know, if Iran, because the context, you know, the subtext here is if Iran is providing this equipment, okay, just like, by the way, the Saudis, which is...
To the Sunnis, you say, yeah.
The Saudis and the Gulf states are providing materiel and supplies to the Sunnis. Is this a reason to go to war in Iran? That's always the subtext here. I mean, why is this a story otherwise?
Add to the question on context is nowhere in these stories is it explained, at least the ones I've read, why the Iranian government would be doing this. The Iranians were delighted to see Saddam Hussein overthrown, and there is now a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad,
as
it is. Why would the Iranian government want to destabilize a Shiite government in Baghdad?
But
now,
let me turn that around.
There may be an argument to be made for realpolitik reasons, or just because they want to be nasty to the Americans or destabilize things just for the hell of it. Somebody might have a plausible explanation for this.
Hegemony, power, control, fear.
We don't see these in the stories. We only see Americans are being killed, lots of specifics about serial numbers and so on and so forth. There's absolutely no context. I just to cite a different approach to the story. After this initial leak to Michael Gordon, and this was set up, of course, I'm sure weeks in advance, where they gave him a heads up. And
you're
they
talking
said,
about the anonymous
the
briefing
story, February,
that occurred the next day.
No, the February 10th story. Where he gives you an advance story on what you're going to be briefed on the next day in Baghdad. He gets the scoop because he's a reliable conduit for these kinds of stories, as he proved when he worked alongside Judith Miller on the aluminum tube stories. He's a reliable guy they can count on to tell the story their way.
We'll hear from Michael Gordon in a moment, yes.
Now, why doesn't Michael Gordon ask in that initial story anybody— any of his sources, what the motive is.
There's no
motive.
But let's talk about motive. Let's turn that around. You accuse the New York Times of disinformation.
I accused them of spreading disinformation.
All right. Why would they want to do that?
Be used by the United States government to spread disinformation.
Well, that's official source reporting.
Let me answer the question.
Yes.
The New York Times historically has played the role of semi-official government newspaper in this country. That's one of the reasons it's been so successful economically and journalistically.
It says it was deeply shamed by what happened before the Iraq War.
I know.
It wants to reprise that.
But people look at the New York Times as the voice of the United States government to some extent. And the New York Times sees itself as the place you're supposed to get the official point of view of the administration. The official point of view of the administration today is that the Iranians are trying to destabilize the situation in Iraq. They're troublemakers. They're a potential target for military action. And so the New York Times gives greater weight to the White House position on this than they give to the skeptical position or the anti-administration position, because that's the historic role of the New York Times.
Christina,
Michael Gordon is not the issue. It's the institutional role of the paper.
We've just got a couple seconds here. Christina, I don't want to put it all in the New York Times. Americans read a lot of other news sources. Is the press at large getting it right, or do you agree with Rick that it's off balance?
Well, I would direct the American public to the same guys who were doing a fantastic job when the Iraq War and during the run-up to the Iraq War. They're now McClatchy, the triad at McClatchy. They used to be the Knight Ridder guys. John Walcott, Jonathan Landay, and Warren Strobel.
We've been joined by Christina Borgeson, author, editor of Feet to the Fire, and John Rick MacArthur, president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. In just a couple seconds, we're going to hear from a couple of big guys at the New York Times. I want to get one call first. Mark from Boxborough, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you today?
Fine. What do you think, Mark?
This is an extremely valuable program. Thank you for putting it on. It seems to me that 4 years after the Iraq War began, we now have a track record, and we know, for example...
Who's we?
Who was we, the American public, the reading public of these newspapers. We know who was right, and we know who has a track record of being wrong. And the complaint I have about the New York Times in particular, but other media in general, and in particular TV, is that too often what we find is the same people who were proven wrong over the last 4 years, wrong about virtually everything, being given prominent airspace to make new allegations. And what we don't see are those people who were proven right given anything like a reasonable hearing.
But the press itself, there's room to learn here, isn't there? I mean, they got their fingers burned. Don't you see them trying harder to be skeptical, to probe more deeply?
Right. Some elements of the press have done that. The New York Times, I would just note, for example, you're going to have Byron Calame on. In January, Mr. Calame agreed that Mr. Gordon had overstepped his bounds by expressing a personal opinion that he thought it was worth giving this surge another shot. That was in late January. Mr. Gordon then wrote his piece on February 10th, which read, the headline of which was "Deadliest Bomb in Iraq is Made by Iran," U.S. says. And nowhere in that article did Mr. Gordon quote anyone that has a proven track record of being right.
Let's go to the source. Rick MacArthur, please stand by. I've got Michael Gordon right here, and the charges are in his lap. You've made them. I want to bring on Michael Gordon. He is military correspondent for the New York Times. He joins us from Washington. Mr. Gordon, thank you for being here.
Okay.
And I have from New York, Byron Calame. He is public editor for the New York Times since May of 2005. Byron Calame, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So there's a lot been put on the table in the last 10 or 15 minutes. Michael Gordon, let me go first to you. This word disinformation, conveying disinformation, put to you. You've been described as a conduit. You heard what our caller just said. There's a lot there. Begin to respond if you would, Michael.
Well, I don't believe I'm the story. I think the story of EFPs in Iraq is really the important thing that needs to be looked at.
These are the explosively formed penetrators from Iran.
I mean, I just would make 2 points. I'll make 3 points. Mm. And, you know, one thing that strikes me about the criticism I heard is it's generally ad hominem, it's shrill, and it doesn't really, in a careful way, dissect the evidence or the case that's been made on EFPs. It's mostly an attack on the messenger, the institution that's in a careful way trying to report this. And, you know, a thing that I find rather odd is that by no means does this evidence that's been presented by the military, that which is asserting there's an Iranian involvement, then by no means does that entail military confrontation with Iran. I mean, for example, I was interviewing Senator Reid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's a Democrat. Mm. He's from Rhode Island. He's a very strong opponent of the surge. He's a sharp critic of the Bush administration. And if you go and read his trip report from Iraq from last July when he visited it, which is a pretty good document, he quotes on the record a British general, General Corelli, was then the three-star in Iraq, is asserting that this lethal IED technology is coming from Iran. And Senator Reid himself believes that there's a persuasive case for this. He thinks this intelligence is credible, as do some people with the Iraq Study Group. The conclusion these people draw from this is not that we should head into some sort of military confrontation with Iran. They conclude from this that we should talk to Iran.
They may, but the carrier group is in the Gulf. All options on the table, we're told, at the top of the White House. If I may follow up on that point, Michael, you were there before the Iraq War. Now here we are looking at Iran. Let me just ask a simple, has your approach changed? Do you find yourself reporting differently, being more skeptical, being more careful to insert that skepticism into your reports, or not?
Let me tell you how I developed this story, and that may help you understand this a little better. I got into this in October. I was in Baghdad, and where I don't think these critics have been recently. And I was trying to shift from an embedded with one battalion to another, and as I was shifting, at the S3, or chief operations officer of that battalion, he was killed by an EFP. And the other person in the Humvee was severely wounded. And I began to inquire, what are these weapons? And I actually didn't set out to write about Iran. I set out to write about these weapons, which were the most dangerous, lethal weapons in Baghdad, used almost exclusively by Shiite militants. And in the process of the reporting, really over several months, the Iran role emerged. And this is not a new allegation. You realize that the British have been making this for some time because they were the first ones to really be affected by EFPs. So there's a long history to this intelligence.
Are you a conduit for official source reporting then? We understand where your interest began as you describe it. You hear the allegation, official source.
Tom.
Yes, sir.
We're reporting the facts of what's happening in Iraq. In December, EFP attacks reached a new high. That's what made this a news story. And the several raids were conducted by the military against Iranian operatives in Iraq, and the media demanded to know more about it. And then when the military gave the media the briefing they were demanding, people turned around and said, oh, my God, you're giving us a briefing. What I can tell you is there's no institution, and Mr. Kalam can, I think, address this better than I because he's looked into it, but I think there's no institution that's more aware of the problems with the previous WMD reporting than the New York Times. And it's well aware that when it tries to report the facts of what's happening in Iraq, there are going to be partisans who are going to make level all sorts of charges, as the people you've heard on your show have done.
I take exception.
Exception noted.
Right,
we'll come back to that. I want to just get Byron Kalam on for a moment. We'll be right to both
joke.
Of you. Hang on. Michael, last thought. I want to go to your colleague.
We had a very careful process for doing this. It took some time. The article will appear if there had never been a briefing. Senior editors were involved. And we tried to. The main flaw in the WMD reporting is we had overlooked initially the dissents within the intelligence community.
Michael Gordon, I'm going to ask you to hold it there if you'd be good enough. Rick MacArthur's listening and describes this as a big joke. You say we're doing our best and going carefully. Byron Kalam, you're there at the New York Times, a public editor. Your job to kind of watch what the paper's doing and talk to the public about it. You described the Times reporting before the Iraq War as having brought deep shame to the paper, but you wrote on Sunday that this time, the reporting reflects healthy levels of skepticism and editing vigilance. Have you got it right?
Well, please remember that two things. One, I said on balance, I think it's been skepticism that's appropriate, that's healthy. Number two, I have to always point out that I do not speak for the New York Times because I sit on a perch outside the whole news operation, looking in much as many readers do until something appears in the paper. I'm really struck by, it's not an obsession, but there's a very strong concern at this newspaper to not let some of the problems, or all of the problems, of pre-war Iraq, of the WMD situation, not happen again. And people are really conscious of that.
Are you confident that it is not then happening again?
I can never find out enough from outside to be absolutely confident, and that's why you find my column was a bit hedged, but I thought it was outstanding. It was excellent that that we were seeing the kind of skepticism that we saw, especially in the Times report out of the Sunday briefing in Baghdad on February 11. The story that was in the Times on February 12 was extremely careful. And I think that the skepticism that's reflected overall, and including, as I pointed out, in Michael's story, in the lead or the second graph, it pointed out that the picture wasn't complete yet. So I think the Times is trying to be careful, and they're. You have to remember, there's a new editing regime. The top editors of this paper are different than they were before the war, and they are extremely concerned about watching the coverage and being personally involved, and all of that is to good effect.
All right, let me turn the microphone the other way. Michael Gordon, Byron Kalam at the Times, please stand by. Rick MacArthur, you said bad joke. What do you mean?
Mr. Kalam. Kalam, excuse me. I think he does a good job under very difficult circumstances. But he's talking about a new editorial regime, but the same publisher. Arthur Sulzberger has been there through the whole thing. And when he does his reporting, he's forced to go back to official sources within the New York Times, like Philip Taubman, the Washington bureau chief, who says, he's asked, did a tip or information come from the policy echelons of the government, from intelligence agencies, from American commanders and troops in Iraq? In this case, he said, quote, Michael Gordon's coverage started at ground level in Iraq and has not been based on policy-driven leaks in Washington, unquote. Now, I don't doubt that Michael Gordon was there when the IED exploded and he wasn't horrified and that this isn't a horrifying thing that's going on to American soldiers. But to suggest that the White House or that the administration didn't then get interested in Michael Gordon as a possible outlet for a stronger case to be made against Iran is preposterous. Philip Taubman is somebody who threw a birthday party, according to New York Magazine, for Condoleezza Rice. He's part of the system. He's in the swim of things. He's within the Washington system.
Are you not also, Michael Gordon says, partisan? Are you not, in a way, part of the system?
He's as much to call me a partisan as, I mean, if he's going to, you know, the implication is that because I'm against the war, that I take my journalistic hat off and I can't see clearly, I could just as well easily say that about the Washington bureau chief of the Times, Philip Taubman, who threw a birthday party for Condoleezza Rice. The second thing, Mr. Kalam, was very good on a few months ago was on the New York Times' failure to publish the National Security Agency illegal wiretap story before the 2004 election when it would have made a difference. They sat on that story. Bill Keller, who is the leader of the new regime, sat on that story for more than a year. And I presume he sat on it because he was very worried about getting the Bush administration angry at the New York Times.
Rick, let me ask you to hold it there.
It still hasn't been explained. So the new editors at the Times are just as frightened of the Bush administration or to some extent as concerned about their position vis-a-vis the Bush administration as they were before when Howell Raines was the editor.
Hold the phone. Christina Burgesson, I have to ask, Americans listening to this around the country have got to be thinking, holy smokes. Listen to these guys debate the very veracity and motivations of almost, of everybody involved here. How are we supposed to make out what's actually going on? Speak to that citizen, you know, shaking their head right now saying, good Lord, how am I supposed to decide?
Before I do that, I want to ask Mr. Gordon something. I'd like to know, Mr. Gordon, have you read my book, Feet to the Fire?
Michael Gordon?
Have you read it?
I mean,
there?
I came they invited me on here to talk about.
No, I'm asking you if you've read it because you said, "Oh, these critics are shrill, ad hominem, et cetera, et cetera." And you know, I think if you've read my book, 21 of the Top Journalists from Ted Koppel on down, I think you might want to reconsider that.
Okay, defense
Secondly,
heard.
Secondly, I'll say yep. this. Mm-hmm. I'll say this. These stories, again, I'm talking about context and analysis. You know, you can report on an event, that's fine, but you have to put it in a context. Otherwise, it makes no sense. If you are telling me that lining up all this stuff that ostensibly Iran provided is not part of a sell job, you know, I have to differ given my, since 2002, investigating and analyzing what happened after 9/11, before Iraq, and now before Iran. I mean, I will step up to the plate right now and tell you a strike on Iran is a fait accompli, if you look, a done deal.
Michael Gordon, how do you respond?
To what?
Well, to this characterization of the war,
to this line of criticism on context.
Well, I mean, Michael? Tom, I mean, again, I mean, I guess the point I would make is, I think twofold. I think I'm making it again. A number of people, your guests on this show and others, have made all sorts of assertions about how our article was done, that such and such a person was a conduit, things of that sort. Mm-hmm. Not a single one of these individuals, mostly bloggers really, but some columnists, not a single one of them, well, maybe with one exception, the woman from the Village Voice, but the has ever called me or contacted a New York Times editor to say, gee, how did you go about doing this? As an institution that's been through the WMD ringer, how did you approach it this time around? So these people have come to whatever conclusions they've come to by violating the most fundamental rule of journalism, which is that when you write about somebody, especially in a kind of a negative way, you should actually contact the person, talk to them, hear their side of it, and then come to your conclusions. None of these people have done that. So that's the sort of standards, or lack of standards, I think, that they apply. And then the other thing is, what I'm disturbed about in the whole tone of this thing is apparently truth is not a defense. I mean, I set out to, and it used to be, I set out to accurately describe as best I could, based on some considerable time of reporting, not based on a briefing. I wasn't at any of these briefings that were held subsequently in Baghdad. I had nothing to do with them. The evidence that the intelligence community has accumulated over a several-year period, Tony Blair asserted this just the other day, as is Senator Reid, so I don't know if they're part of some conspiracy in the mind of your critics, but to present the case as the intelligence community understands it, to note that it's incomplete, and we're continuing to report on that.
Byron Kalaim, Christina Borgeson, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, John.
We've been joined by John Rick MacArthur, president and publisher of Harper's Magazine, author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, looking back to that time a decade and more ago now. Joined as well by Michael Gordon, military correspondent for The New York Times. He's written a lot and taken a lot of heat. You hear him defending his approach today. We'll hear in a moment from another guest looking at the nuclear side of this equation, but I want to get some of our listeners in. So many have been ringing in. Barbara is on the phone, on the air, from Boston. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to make two points. One is that I heard an interview with Scott Ritter, who was an inspector with the U.S. WMD search team in Iraq.
Before, yeah.
And I heard that about a year ago, 9 months or a year ago. And he said that the U.S. was preparing an attack on Iran and that U.S. troops were gathering at the northern borders of Iran and also other preparations.
Okay. If that's what he said, does that make it true or how does that factor in here, Barbara?
It's because he was obviously, he was an expert and he didn't find any WMD. And so he was warning, he was predicting this. And then about a month ago, former National Security Advisor Brzezinski was before Congress and predicted the same thing and said that the government was preparing an attack on Iran and that they were going to cite incidents with Iran and provocations by Iran.
So you're skeptical and you're finding sources to support your skepticism, but is the press doing its job?
Yes. Yeah, but I think that the press has more access to information than I do, and I feel that these warnings are not even mentioned. And
Barbara, we've got it. I want to get a couple more calls real quick here. Tom from Providence, Rhode Island. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, there was really two points I wanted to make. One was that, is the press going to get it right, and whose, fault is it that it's all confused to this degree? And I think there's plenty of blame to go around. I mean, I think the media and the New York Times certainly have some well-deserved credibility issues. On the other hand, I think Michael makes some good points that certainly the rationale that he's making for how he's approaching things makes sense to me, and he makes a very good point that the consumers are not doing enough hard-headed thinking of their own. And to that end, actually, I really, your show is one of my favorite because I think it's you don't buy into that as much as everybody else does. And I think, like I said, it's up to the consumer as much to be able to have some critical thinking and to directly respond to the media if they think they're not getting it right. And I don't think there's been enough of that going on.
Tom, we appreciate it. Rick MacArthur, do you feel enough public skepticism to sort of guard them against what you allege is going on here? Michael Gordon sees it differently, but is the public armed by experience?
I'm still hoping somebody's going to ask Mr. Gordon what the motive of the Iranian government is if they are indeed supplying these IEDs to the Shiite insurgents.
That question will be asked.
Will you please ask him that question for me? I'm tired of playing internal affairs cop. I've done enough of this kind of reporting to last a lifetime. But in answer to the first caller's question, I make it my business in my newspaper column to interview Iranian sources. And I talk to a lot of Iranians, including Iranian government officials. And they are not persuaded by Scott Ritter's point of view. They don't think the Bush administration has the political capacity at this point to launch a new war or to even to launch a limited bombing strike on Iraq. Excuse me, on Iran. They think that the story is being oversold from the skeptical point of view. At least these are the official people that I'm talking to. I certainly can see a gray area where it's possible the Bush administration is pushing the envelope as far as they can. And even if they don't have the political strength to attack Iran or to use Israel to bomb Iran as a proxy for the United States, they could still be happy to muddy the waters because
to build a negotiating strength or leverage.
But also leverage and also by leverage with the Iranian government that would lead to eventual talks. But also to distract attention from, as I think we talked about earlier in the program, Saudi unofficial subsidies of the Sunni insurgents who are causing much more damage, killing far more American soldiers.
Okay, I've got some questions for Michael as well, but put yours to him, just straight to him so there's no interference here. What's your question about the Iranian motivation?
My question is, what's the Iranian motivation? Why would the government, having hated Saddam Hussein and now enjoying a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad, be trying to destabilize the American military and the Shiite government that the American military backs up?
Michael Gordon, what do you say?
I'm not a spokesman for the Iranian government, but I can explain what I think the American intelligence community view is of Iranian motivations. And I think the way they look at it is that, first off, that Iran has really embarked on a policy of what they call managed chaos. I mean, Iran's goal is to raise the cost of the American occupation of Iraq, to bring closer the day when American troops leave Iraq, and also to solidify its ties with Shiite militant groups in that country. And I think that would be the motivation if you were to get some American intelligence experts aside and say, why are they doing this?
May I ask you a question on just that point Michael? If I may, Rick. Michael, so you're then, in effect, here in the print you've done it, and on the air you're saying this is the American intelligence community view. Now, where does your job then as a reporter, where does your responsibility extend? Just to tell us that? Does that leave you with the official sources reporting label on you? Are you responsible to go beyond that then and for the context Christina was talking about to tell us whether or not that American intelligence community view makes sense or not?
Well, first of all, I'm being very careful to
you're attributing it, and we hear that.
to identify what their view is, so to separate their view from any kind of personal view of my own.
But what about context beyond their view? That's what I'm asking about, because then their view stands there.
Tom.
Yes, sir.
I've been in 4 years of reporting on Iraq, much of which was critical of the administration. You know, people haven't cited that. I'm the guy that broke the Steve Hadley memo story, mm-hmm. in which the administration mm-hmm. expressed doubts about the Maliki government that mm-hmm. many of the critics have cited.
Nobody again and again.
Complained
yep.
about that when mm-hmm. I broke it, but in any event, except from the other side of the spectrum. But since the very first days of this invasion and occupation, there has been a battle, a contest for influence within Iraq between the Iranian government and the American government. It's no surprise. It's gone on in the political arena, and it's gone on in the military arena. And much of this case on EFPs that I'm familiar with, what's different, I think, from the WMD episode is in the case of WMD in Iraq, the American intelligence was on the outside looking in. It had very few sources in the country. It was basically extrapolating from old data. In this case, for better or worse, we're in. And this is really battlefield intelligence. Every time a Humvee gets hit by an EFP, someone picks up the pieces, takes the copper plate, does a kind of forensic analysis, compares it with previous strikes, and does a tabulation. So this is battlefield intelligence gathered in Iraq. It's kind of from the bottom up, not from the top down. And I think that's really what the case is based on, and that's why so much of it is really being presented out there and not back here in Washington.
All right. And of course, we hear that, and that is exactly where a lot of people now feel skepticism, because there was so much top-down before. I've got to bring in one more voice here.
We need to be specific. Who were the civilian briefers who – you weren't there, Mr. Gordon, but who were the civilian briefers who went to Baghdad to brief James Glanz and the other reporter –
the anonymous briefers.
Who did the story the next day. And why weren't they allowed to photograph? Why weren't they allowed
to tape
record anything?
Yeah, I can answer.
Good question, Michael.
I'm sorry?
Yes, your answer?
Well, I didn't organize this briefing. But I think that my understanding of what happened is, first of all, I would refer you to the New York Times article that ran in yesterday's newspaper, in which a military expert, a major in the U.S. Army, who's Mr. IED in Iraq, was quoted on the record as explaining their case.
But go back, because Rick's asking about a particular, he's suggesting there was top-down fingerprint.
Who were those people?
Who were those people?
Who went to the briefing? Yeah, they obviously got parachuted in. Who were they?
Well, I believe there were people from out there who were not parachuted in, and I believe that in response to the many complaints that it was on background, that the Multinational Forces Iraq later produced an on-the-record briefing, and there was an on-the-record interview with an expert in yesterday's New York Times by Glanz and Rich Oppel, and a very proficient article they did that examined all the technical data and certainly had an ample amount of skepticism.
All right, I want to lift the sights. I have to lift the sights here a moment from the.
It's not on the record. It is on the record.
That was. I want to lift off of the battlefield level here for a minute and go to the nuclear question, because it's been very much in the headlines, and of course it surrounds all the IED, EFP, PIR, and all the rest of it. David Albright joins us from Washington. He's president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Former UN weapons inspector, an early skeptic of the Bush administration's claims on aluminum tubes, evidence of a nuclear program in Iraq. He's been watching all the press reporting at the nuclear level. David Albright, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Glad to be here.
So help us step up to the nuclear question and the reporting there for just a moment. Our time is short, but do you see the U.S. press on the nuclear allegation level bringing the American public an adequately clear and accurate position or representation of what's going on?
I think it's not doing too bad of a job. I mean, there's certainly been struggles with the media. I think they do listen too much to the administration and are not skeptical enough. And I would like to add one thing. I mean, talking about these EFPs, I think the problem I've had, and I thought this story by Glanz and Oppel was moving in the direction that's healthy, and I think healthy in this case means skepticism, is that I don't have any problems with what Michael's saying about the battleground intelligence. It's the extrapolation that the Iranian government or regime is behind it that is the problem. And I think what Glantz and Oppel were trying to do, but I don't think that didn't happen in this article sufficiently, is that what about the case of the insurgents smuggling the parts out of Iran, and that in a sense it's driven by the insurgents, but they're going into Iran to get the parts because that's actually the closest and most reliable supplier. But it's nothing. The Iranian government or regime at the highest levels has nothing to do with this. Now, that can be tested by seeing what the Iranians do to try to shut down this business. If they are clean, then they should be working to stop what could be illegal activities in Iran and producing parts or sale of parts that then end up being used in Iran. And I think the Times story did not get into that in this one.
So you're taking us right back to the EFP, Michael Gordon. What about it? The implication was put out there. The administration later kind of backed away, but that this came from very high levels in the Iranian government. Here's the view that the Times and others have sort of left that sitting out there, though, as the implication when it's not justified, that maybe it's just rebels going to Iran, getting stuff, coming back.
Well, first of all, that's a distortion of the New York Times reporting. I wrote an article with Mark Mazzetti in which we devoted the entire article to this dispute within the government as to what level of Iranian government might be involved. The view of the American intelligence community, and it's been asserted, is that activity that's gone on for 3 years that's this systematic, that involves the provision of these weapon components, could not be carried out without the knowledge of some senior-level Iranian officials. That's the U.S. intelligence community view of all 16 agencies. The view of General Pace, as has been amply reported, is that he's not, while he's persuaded the supply is coming from Iran, he doesn't draw the conclusion that Iranian leaders are necessarily cognizant of that, and we've explored that debate. That's really an assessment as to how likely you think this could go on without the Iranian leadership being aware of it, and the U.S. government has previously raised its concerns to the Iranian government. That was in my initial article.
I want to think, which raises another question of why Mr. Gordon didn't call General Pace and get comment from him on the first story, or somebody speaking for General Pace.
Well, General Pace made his comments after the first story. General Pace was traveling around the world. I think he made them from Australia and then later again from Southeast Asia in reference, which followed the briefing. It was several days after the story that he made his observations about the intelligence community.
Rick MacArthur, our time is so short. Rick, where does this, in your view, leave us? We've heard what Michael has to say, Byron, and a bit of David will hear more, but where does this leave the country, the American public, trying to figure this out, you know, when there's so much at stake? We've seen what can happen.
Well, it leaves the American people subject to all sorts of wild stuff on the Internet, which is not a good thing. It leaves us very poorly informed from what used to be our best newspapers, which can't tell a story straight anymore. I've been telling people that they're better off reading the Associated Press than they are reading the New York Times these days, because at least the Associated Press still has the habit of going the extra mile to get a contradictory statement. So-and-so, an high official source said today, X, you go find somebody who says, who contradicts it. Why contradicts it?
But I'm seeing that right here in the lead of yesterday's Time story. Critics contend that the forensic case remains circumstantial and inferential.
And I will grant that the Times is doing a somewhat better job than they were doing. But as I said, if you go through the story very carefully, you see the way they load it. The skeptics are called liberals, and Mr. Gordon calls them partisans, as though Tony Blair wasn't a partisan, or the people working for the White House weren't partisans in making their case against Iran or for EFPs or whatever.
Michael Gordon,
Times is still, and institutional journalism is still weighing it heavily towards the government's point of view, the administration's point of view. It's easier, it's safer. You don't get in any trouble with your bosses if you do that. And if you start going around looking for people like David Albright, you buy trouble at your newspaper, let me tell you.
Michael, is it still, what is it like to go out? Our time is so short, but to go out in this kind of atmosphere with this level of skepticism of the work of the press, of your work, what's it like to go out and do it every day?
Well, all I can tell you is, first of all, it's not safer. I and our, especially my colleagues in Baghdad, take risks every day that many.
I didn't say physically.
Don't.
I said politically safer. Politically safer.
Michael, it's not politically safer because we know we're inviting scrutiny, but we have to tell the story the way we report it. We knew that we would, that there would be critics like this, but I think the stories are quite accurate, very well documented, and we're making a continued effort to lay it out. We just have to report the story as it is, not as people would like it to.
And that's it for the hour. Michael Gordon with the New York Times, John Rick MacArthur at Harper's Magazine, and David Albright at ISIS. Thank you all for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.